Are you worried about the climate emergency and looking to do something about it? Join the Kingston Climate Justice Coalition for a special town hall event on Saturday, September 28th. Space is limited. Follow at Climate Coalition CA on Instagram and Facebook to register and learn more.
Join CFRC at Kingston Writers Fest for At a Loss for Words with Carol Off on September 29th at 10:45 at the Screening Room. In a world where wokeness and fake news are thrown around as pejoratives, Carol Off offers her insight on how to mindfully traverse the current global political climate with the best vocabulary we have access to. Join her for a look inside her latest book, At a Loss for Words, which delves into the meaning of her six chosen words, freedom, democracy, truth, woke, choice, and taxes, unpacking the forces from right and left that have altered them beyond recognition. For more information, festival passes, and single event tickets, visit kingstonwritersfest.ca.
It is 12 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Sudan's conflict has so far killed more than 20,000 people. This is an underestimate, by the way. Displaced over 10 million people inside the country and forced another 2 million to flee to neighboring countries. This is the largest internal displacement of people in the world today.
A UN fact-finding mission reports harrowing human rights violations by both sides in Sudan's brutal civil war. We'll look at a new investigative report uncovering gruesome details and footage of an ethnically motivated massacre of civilians by rapid support forces in North Darfur. And we'll speak with Human Rights Watch about their new report calling for an expanded arms embargo on Sudan. Then Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier turned 80 years old this week in prison after nearly a half century behind bars for a crime he says he did not commit.
They wouldn't allow me to put up a defense and manufactured evidence, manufactured witnesses, tortured witnesses.
We'll speak with Leonard Peltier's legal defense team and with the president of the Indigenous-led NDN Collective. Then, how we do freedom, rising against fascism.
It's a day-long education, activation on what is fascism and what we do to stop it.
We'll speak with V, the playwright formerly known as Eve Ensler. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli strikes have killed at least 40 people across Gaza today, as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is once again calling for an immediate ceasefire following Israel's massacre at the UNRUD Al-Jiyuni School, which killed at least 18 people Wednesday, including six UN workers, the deadliest day in UNRWA's history. The World Health Organization said Thursday it had evacuated about 100 people in need of medical treatment from Gaza to the United Arab Emirates and called for regular evacuations to resume after Israel's assault decimated Gaza's health system. This is a cancer patient awaiting evacuation.
I am suffering from Hodgkin's lymphoma, and this type of cancer spreads very quickly. In 1 or 2 months, it spreads throughout your entire body, unlike other types of cancer. My trip was extremely tiring, and I came here to the south so I can travel and get treated outside the country by God's will.
In related news, the WHO says a quarter of Palestinians in Gaza wounded by Israel's ongoing assault have life-changing injuries. The UN is warning the Palestinian economy, which was already devastated before October 7th due to Israel's occupation and blockade, is in free fall and could completely collapse. The body of Aishanur Ezgi Egi, the 26-year-old Turkish-American activist who was killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank during a peaceful protest, has arrived in Turkey ahead of her funeral. On Thursday, Aishanur's father, Mehmet Suat Egi, praised Turkey for investigating the killing and called on the U.S. to do the same.
America is a different country.
America is a different country. When there is injustice or torment towards its citizens, or they are killed in any country in the world, it lands on that country like the eagle on its emblem. But when the subject is Israel, there is more of an effort to dodge it. But I want to believe that people will listen to their conscience.
Earlier this week, the Washington Post published an investigation corroborating eyewitness accounts that the protests Aishanur Ezgi Egi had been taking part in were already over when Israeli soldiers opened fire, killing her. Meanwhile, three top Democrats from Aishanur's home state of Washington, Senators Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, and Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, called on the Biden administration to investigate her killing. On Wednesday, hundreds of people gathered at a Seattle beach for a vigil honoring the recent University of Washington graduate. A North Dakota judge struck down the state's near-total abortion ban Thursday, ruling North Dakota's constitution ensures the right to an abortion before fetal viability. While the ruling's a major victory for abortion rights, North Dakota no longer has any abortion clinics after the overturning of Roe v. Wade triggered the state's ban. If the ruling is not overturned in an appeal or the state legislature does not pass a new ban, North Dakota could join Minnesota as a haven for patients seeking abortion care in the Midwest. Some 33,000 Boeing workers in Washington State and Oregon are walking off the job after overwhelmingly rejecting a new contract. It's Boeing's first strike in 16 years and will halt production on most of its aircrafts, including its troubled 737 MAX. Workers are seeking pay raises of 40%. The tentative agreement only pledged to raise wages by 25%. In related news, hotel workers in Boston, New Haven, and San Diego have launched the second wave of a phased strike that started at hotels around the United States on Labor Day. A federal jury in Florida has found members of a Pan-Africanist group guilty of conspiring with the Russian government to sow discord and interfere in U.S. elections. Activists with the African People's Socialist Party face up to 5 years in federal prison. They plan to appeal. Prosecutors argued the group's activities were not protected by the First Amendment since they were done at the direction of a Russian operative named Alexander Inoval. The defense argued the government aimed to censor the group after members criticized U.S. foreign policy. Jurors acquitted three of the activists, known as the Uhuru Three, on a more serious charge of acting as agents of a foreign government. Attorney Mutaki Akbar spoke after the verdict.
We had 12 people from this community that probably don't agree with most of the stuff that they heard, but understood their right to do it, one, and two, their sovereignty in doing so, that they were doing it on their own behalf for African people. So I think that sends a message to the government that these political prosecutions probably won't work.
To see our interview with one of those on trial, Omali Yeshitela, chair of the African People's Socialist Party, about the trial of the Uhuru Three, visit democracynow.org. A judge in Georgia has dismissed two more charges against Donald Trump and one charge against some of his co-defendants in the state's 2020 election subversion case. Trump now faces 8 charges in the racketeering conspiracy, down from the original 13. In other Trump news, the former president says he will not take part in any more debates against Kamala Harris before the election. In Springfield, Ohio, a bomb threat on Thursday prompted authorities to order the evacuation of City Hall and several municipal buildings. Mayor Rob Roos said the threat came in an email from someone who cited frustration over the city's resettlement of Haitian immigrants. This comes after Springfield city manager denied false racist claims made by former President Trump and vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance that Haitian immigrants were eating people's dogs and cats. Several Democratic senators have criticized the Biden administration's move to send $1.3 billion in military funding to Egypt, citing widespread human rights abuses by the authoritarian government of General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. A portion of the money, less than a quarter, was conditioned on Egypt improving its human rights record. On Thursday, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy wrote, quote, "It's no secret Egypt remains a deeply repressive autocratic state. I see no good reason to ignore that fact by waiving these requirements," he said. This comes as press freedom groups are demanding Egyptian authorities drop all charges against four journalists recently detained and held incommunicado. The disappearances of Ashraf Omar, Khaled Mamdou, Ramadan Guida, and Yasser Abu Ella have sparked fear and trauma among Egyptian journalists. At least two of them have allegedly been tortured. In Nigeria, people are searching for their loved ones after major flooding killed at least 30 people, submerged entire neighborhoods, and displaced tens of thousands of people in the northeast.
I have one son, and I have not seen or heard from him in 3 days. We got out on Tuesday after the flood overpowered us. It was really hard for us to get out, but thanks to the soldiers who helped us to safety. Right now, we are still searching for my son. No headway yet. We pray to God to help us in this situation.
Democratic lawmakers Thursday unveiled the Polluters Pay Climate Fund Act that would force fossil fuel companies to pay into a fund that addresses the harm and damages they caused, unquote. In related news, pressure's mounting for the Biden administration to cancel all new liquefied natural gas export licenses after a judge recently lifted a pause on new LNG export approvals and after a new study found that LNG has a 33% greater greenhouse gas footprint than coal. Here in New York, Police Commissioner Edward Caban resigned Thursday at the request of Mayor Eric Adams. Caban's resignation came just days after federal agents searched his home and seized his cell phone. Agents also raided the homes of a top mayoral advisor, two deputy mayors, and the New York City schools chancellor. It's one of the four separate corruption investigations by federal prosecutors targeting Adams' inner circle. And Chilean President Gabriel Boric says he will push for the repeal of a highly contested amnesty law that has long barred investigations into crimes against humanity committed during General Augusto Pinochet's military dictatorship. On Wednesday, September 11th, Boric attended a ceremony marking the 51st anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup, which overthrew elected President Salvador Allende and ushered in Pinochet's 17-year dictatorship, during which thousands of people were murdered, tortured, and disappeared. This is Jaime Vivanco, a relative of some of the victims.
Our society still does not assume that it has an historical duty to vindicate the disappeared detainees, the politically executed, and the tortured people. We must learn from this and understand that if we do not assume this as a society, then never again is not real and can be repeated.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Sudan, where a UN fact-finding mission has reported harrowing human rights violations, many of which amount to war crimes committed by both the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Members of the UN mission described indiscriminate attacks by the warring parties on civilians, schools, hospitals, water and power supplies. Civilians have also been subjected to torture, arbitrary detention and gruesome sexual violence by both sides.
In the context of the current conflict, civilians, an overwhelming majority of whom are women and children, women and girls, were and continue to be targeted with sexual violence, in particular rape, gang rape, by both parties to the conflict. Members of the RSF, in particular, have perpetrated sexual violence on a large scale in the context of attacks on cities in Darfur region and the greater Khartoum area.
Sudan's military and the RSF rejected calls by the UN experts to deploy an international force to protect civilians from the devastating war that erupted in April of 2023, so far killing more than 20,000 people, displacing some 13 million from their homes. This is the World Health Organization's chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, speaking from Port Sudan.
Sudanese are suffering through a perfect storm of crisis. Over 500 days of conflict, the largest level of displacement in the world, famine in some parts and risk of this in others, 25.6 million people, over half of Sudanese population, are expected to face high levels of acute food insecurity.
After over 16 months of fighting, much of Sudan's healthcare system has also collapsed, leading to the outbreak of disease, including cholera. Massive floods and torrential rains in recent weeks have compounded the catastrophe, with dozens of reported deaths, the further destruction of vital infrastructure, and more disruptions to the delivery of life-saving humanitarian aid. For more, we're joined by two guests. Yusra Abahir is Africa correspondent at Sky News. Her latest piece, titled Sudan War, Massacre on the Streets, part of a joint investigation with Lighthouse Reports, The Washington Post, and Le Monde, uncovering gruesome details of footage of the June 2023 ethnically motivated massacre of civilians by rapid support forces in North Darfur's town of Khartoum. Their investigations, the first time visual evidence has emerged showing fighters linked with the RSF directly involved in the extrajudicial killings of unarmed civilians. She's joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. And in Paris, we're joined by Jean-Baptiste Galapin, senior crisis, conflict, and arms researcher at Human Rights Watch, which has just released a new report titled Fanning the Flames, Sudanese Warring Parties, Access to New Foreign-Made Weapons and Equipment. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's go to Yusra first in Nairobi, Kenya. Talk about what's happening in your home country of Sudan right now, what people should understand about the depth of this catastrophe.
Well, Amy, I think everyone can remember the genocide in the early 2000s, 2003 genocide in Darfur, where there was outcry, outrage around inhumanity that was being seen in the Darfur region, the suppression of people's voices that was happening in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. There was an outcry and a rejection of the violence happening there. I was in school in Sudan at the time, and though the military regime had completely censored press from speaking on the conflict in Darfur in 2003, we heard from it from outside. We heard about it from the international community because the noise about it was so difficult to ignore, even in the seat of power in Khartoum. Now it's the opposite. Now it is complete apathy and neglect. The global community is essentially turning away 20 years on when we have similar atrocities happening in the Darfur region and spreading to the country. I got a message earlier from a source who helped us on the investigation. He asked me if the Western world was complicit, if they're in on it, because he himself is shocked to see that no one seems to care, that he feels that there's an aiding and abetting of the RSF through allies of the West like the UAE. And there just seems to be a lot of confusion and despair about why the world doesn't seem to be taking this seriously.
Yusra, I wanted to turn to that joint investigation you just did between Sky News, Lighthouse Reports, Washington Post, and the French paper Le Monde, which uncovers these gruesome details and footage of the June 2023 ethnically motivated massacre of civilians by rapid support forces in North Darfur's town of Khartoum. The investigation, marking the first time visual evidence has emerged showing fighters linked with RSF directly involved in the extrajudicial killing of unarmed civilians. This is a clip of your video report.
Safia's husband was one of the soldiers killed in the battle, but civilian men in her family were targeted too.
My three cousins and two of my brothers were stood up and shot dead. My father would have been killed too if he hadn't fled. We had to bury my brothers in the yard with some dirt and leave them behind.
Residents say they'd never seen anything like it, even compared to the 2003 conflict in Darfur, designated as genocide.
This time, these guys conquer the army, and then they come for the civilians. If you have a car, they'll take it. They'll take anything in your home. If you have pretty sisters, they'll rape them.
You can see the rest of this investigation on Sky News website, news.sky.com. Yusra Bragir, it was your voice that we heard there. You were the correspondent on this investigation. What shocked you most? This was a massacre that took place a year ago. But how much has things changed?
Well, we were on the border with West Darfur when the war started, and we were seeing people come out of West Darfur with bullets in them, children. I remember a three-year-old having a bullet in his hip, and they were being targeted by the Arab militias that the RSF is linked to, based solely on their ethnicity. A couple of days later, this massacre that we reported on recently happened, and it was a town-wide massacre that spread also to the displacement camp, Kassab, which was actually built to house persecuted communities from the Darfur genocide in the early 2000s. So we had already seen the violence play out and we saw it live. But what shocked me, Amy, was the videos, the visual evidence that we put forward in the report that Lighthouse shared with us, that kind of spurred on this investigation, where these tribal militiamen are celebrating over lifeless bodies of unarmed civilians, saying victory to the Arabs. They're cheering on their violence. We spent a lot of time tracking down the victims that we see in those videos, tracking down their people closest to them to understand who they were, what their relation was with the RSF, why they were being targeted in this way. And they were simply unarmed civilians. We were even told repetitively they don't have any history of altercation. One of them was a university student. One of them was a cattle herder. One of them was only 14 years old. They were found in a door-to-door hunt of civilian men of fighting age from non-Arab tribes. So to see this happen very early on, I started to feel like it was a template for the massacres and the atrocities that we saw in the months that followed. Because what happened in that town was that the army garrison was taken over by the RSF, and then they kind of sanctioned this rampage, this massacre on the town. It was the second garrison to fall in Darfur after the RSF kind of took over Khartoum. The first one in Darfur, Kabkabiya, there was very little fight. And this garrison is being credibly accused of being sold out to the RSF. Army sources told us that senior commanders colluded with the RSF before the attack. And then in the months that followed, we see a similar pattern. An abrupt withdrawal from army garrisons. The RSF takes over towns and then starts to carry out atrocities against civilians. And that is terrifying. It's terrifying because the civilians, they're essentially defenseless. The army can't be trusted to protect civilians. And the RSF is currently in control of 4 out of 5 of states in Darfur.
I want to bring Jean-Baptiste Galopin into this conversation, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. If you can tell us more about fanning the flames, Sudanese warring parties' access to new foreign-made weapons and equipment, where are all these weapons coming from that are killing so many Sudanese civilians?
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me. So, you know, we at Human Rights Watch, we monitor social media for evidence of crimes. And over the past year, we were shocked to see the growing number of apparently new weapons that the warring parties are using in the conflict, weapons that are kind of very sophisticated pieces of modern equipment and made abroad. So we analyzed this content and identified the equipment and published this report, which presents the equipment that we believe was newly acquired. And that includes armed drones, different types of these of such drones, truck-mounted multi-barrel rocket launcher systems, explosive munitions, drone jammers, as well as anti-tank guided missiles. And these weapons were made in countries such as Serbia, Russia, China, the UAE and Iran, and both sides are using them. So we're very concerned that in the context of widespread atrocities being carried out in Sudan by both sides, these weapons are very likely to be used to commit human rights violations and war crimes. And we've actually found evidence in this report of drones used by the military being used to attack apparent civilians in the Khartoum area.
And again, name the countries where the weapons are coming from.
So this includes Serbia, Russia, China, Iran, the UAE. And so we found, for instance, that the Sudanese military is using the Mohajer 6 drone, which is really a latest generation a drone manufactured by the Iranian Ministry of Defense. You know, we found the RSF using attack drones that we couldn't identify, but that are used with in tandem with thermobaric munitions that weapon crates show were first purchased by the United Arab Emirates from Serbia before finding their way to the RSF. And these weapons are used across the country, including in Darfur, but also in the Khartoum area, as well as Kordofan. And so that really illustrates that the existing arms embargo on Darfur, which was established in 2004 in the context of the Darfur conflict at the time, is really inadequate in light of the changed situation in the country. As you mentioned, today, the majority of Sudan's federal states are seeing violence, and there is very little enforcement of this embargo. So the UN Security Council a few days ago voted to renew the embargo, but we actually are calling for the Security Council to expand it to the whole of Sudan to ensure these weapons, to curb the flow of weapons and protect civilians.
Can I ask Yusra, why are these countries involved with what's going on in Sudan right now, this humanitarian catastrophe? Serbia, China, Russia, UAE.
I mean, Sudan is literally a gold mine, Amy. I mean, we've got massive gold mines. We've got uranium deposits. We've got an 800-kilometer Red Sea coastline. We're also a corridor country, and we are the third largest country in Africa. I think the instability in Sudan has been exploited by international powers for a long time. But now it really is kind of up for the taking. I mean, Omar al-Bashir, the former military dictator, made his money selling Sudan for parts. He'd already had a deal with Russia before he was ousted in the 2019 revolution. He already had deals with the UAE and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia on kind of corrupt hundreds of years of leases on arable land. He'd kind of set the precedent for making money, making Sudan a lucrative business for kleptocrats. And so once he was ousted, the power vacuum was quickly filled with his henchmen, with his inspector general, who's now the army chief, and his opponent, Hemeti, the head of the RSF, was al-Bashir's favorite militiaman. He led the counterinsurgency in Darfur in the early 2000s as the head of a Janjaweed militia. So these guys have seen what al-Bashir has managed to do with the country, and they're cashing in on it. And all of these countries that are involved are definitely exploiting the vulnerability, and some of them had an active hand in suppressing the protests in 2019. I mean, both the UAE and Russia have been credibly accused of helping the government at the time to track down protesters, to lobby online propaganda campaigns, especially Russia. And this is just a continuation of that, I think.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to follow the story. Sky News Africa correspondent Yusra Abakhir, speaking to us from Nairobi, Kenya, a Sudanese journalist, and Jean-Baptiste Galopin, senior crisis, conflict and arms researcher at Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Paris, France. We'll link to your reports at Sky News and to the Human Rights Watch investigation. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Leonard Peltier turns 80 years old in prison. He's been there for half a century. Stay with us.
Hello. أنا رحى ♪
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Amnesty International is calling on President Biden to grant clemency to the indigenous leader, Leonard Peltier, who turned 80 years old Thursday after nearly half a century in prison for a crime he says he did not commit. Peltier has always maintained his innocence over the 1975 killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation, his conviction riddled with irregularities and prosecutorial misconduct. In a letter to President Biden last week, Amnesty International USA wrote, quote, "Given the ongoing unresolved concerns about the fairness of Leonard Peltier's trial and legal process, that he spent nearly 50 years in prison, his age, the recent denial of parole and compassionate release, and ongoing and chronic health issues, we're asking you to commute Leonard Peltier's sentence and release him. This is not only timely, but a necessary measure in the interests of both justice and mercy," they wrote. For more on Leonard Peltier's case, we're joined by Nick Tilson, president of the NDN Collective, an indigenous-led organization, citizen of the Oglala Lakota Nation, joining us from Atlanta, Georgia. We're also joined by two members of Leonard Peltier's legal defense team. Jennifer Jones is the managing attorney at the law firm For the People, lead counsel for Leonard Peltier's case, joining us from Denver, Colorado. And here in New York, we're joined by Maura Meltzer-Cohen, co-counsel on the case, educator and abolitionist. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Jennifer Jones. For people who have not followed Leonard Peltier's case, I know he's in the Coleman prison in Florida, and he just came out of a number of days in the prison hospital, just turned 80 years old. Explain why he is behind bars and still behind bars after 50 years.
Well, good morning. Thank you, Amy, for having me on. And that is quite a question and a complex question because it has a lot to do with Leonard. What is keeping Leonard in prison now? I think what's important to clarify is the things that put Leonard in prison, those irregularities, those defects, that the misconduct are different from the things that are holding him in there today. So the procedures, the conditions of confinement, the law that is being used by the United States Parole Commission, which we assert is the wrong law and therefore in violation of the ex post facto clause to the U.S. Constitution. And that's also consistent with the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention and their evaluation of Leonard's current detention and incarceration right now. He's an old law prisoner. There's a complex set of laws that are currently keeping him in. And so we've been very clear, myself and co-counsel, that we intend to bring this to court. Leonard's case has not been reviewed by a court in over a decade. And yet there are still matters, substantive matters, that have not been raised in his case. And we intend to do that, including the medical issues, of course, other treaty violations and due process, serious due process issues that are causing him to be bound within the carceral system at this point, though he is 80 years old, reliant on a walker, has severe diabetes and a host of other health conditions for which he should not at all be incarcerated at this time. And apart from the fact, notwithstanding the fact that Congress did not intend for Leonard to be, or any prisoner convicted at that time of the offense, to be incarcerated in this particular manner.
I spoke to Leonard Peltier on the phone from prison in Florida in 2012 during the Obama administration. Leonard, this is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!
Hi,
I'm good. I was wondering if you have a message for President Obama.
I just hope he can, stop the wars that are going on in the world and stop killing all those people getting killed and, give the Black Hills back to my people and turn me loose.
Can you share with people at the news conference and with President Obama your case for why you should be, your sentence should be commuted, why you want clemency?
Well, I've never got a fair trial, for one. They wouldn't allow me to put up a defense and manufactured evidence, manufactured witnesses, tortured witnesses. After 37 years for clemency, or house arrest at least.
So that was Leonard Peltier in 2012. In November 2000, on Election Day, I had a chance to interview then-President Bill Clinton, who'd called into our radio station, Pacifica Station WBAI, to get out the vote for Hillary for Senate and Al Gore for president. I used the opportunity to ask him about the case of Leonard Peltier.
President Clinton, since it's rare to get you on the phone, let me ask you another question. That is, what is your position on granting Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist, executive clemency?
Well, I don't have a position I can announce yet. I believe there is a new application for him in there. And when I have time after the election's over, I'm going to review all the remaining executive clemency applications. And see what the merits dictate. I will try to do what I think the right thing to do is based on the evidence.
So that was almost a quarter of a century ago. Maura Meltzer-Cohen, your co-counsel on the case, you attended the parole hearing in July. Talk about the significance of this.
Well, Leonard had not had a full reconsideration hearing for parole, I believe, since 2008. We put together a comprehensive parole submission for him. We were really committed to getting all of the evidence before the parole commission. And just to give you a sense of this, his parole submission was two volumes. It was nearly 500 pages, or a little over 500 pages. And of course, it included not only letters of support and assurance from his friends and family and supporters, but many, many letters from experts, including, of course, a doctor and a social worker, his spiritual advisor, but also from historians, sociologists, criminologists, experts on aging in prison, experts on the history of the case. We had a really beautiful letter on the ways in which his continued confinement far from his ancestral lands is a violation of not only treaty law, but religious free exercise rights. We included letters from people who had lived through the Reign of Terror on Pine Ridge, not just people who had been present, but former law enforcement. We had letters supporting release from people who had been involved in the original prosecution and appeal, not just his defense attorneys, but people who had represented the government in prosecuting Mr. Peltier about why they had ultimately, if belatedly, determined that he ought to be released. And even the Vatican sent a message of support for his release.
I want to bring Nick Tilson into this conversation, president and CEO of NDN Collective, an indigenous-led organization, usually on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, where the shootout took place. Your parents were at that time there. If you can talk about the history of Leonard Peltier's case, now you're in Atlanta, and the significance of what he has argued all of these years with these two FBI agents coming onto the reservation. The case against Leonard Peltier, he has always denied that he killed these two FBI agents in a shootout.
I mean, I think the most important thing to remember or for people to understand is there was a war happening on that side at that time. And the United States government was arming one side of that battle. And there was hundreds of agents in and out of Pine Ridge during that time. Those agents came up to the camp in 1975 with aggression at a time in which people were being killed for standing up for indigenous people's rights. The conditions at that time were directly related to why his co-defendants were originally let off. Dino Butler, Bob Robidoux. And they were let off because of reasons for self-defense. And because of the climate that was happening at that time on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And the United States government and the Federal Bureau of Investigation were engaging in a counterintelligence war to shut down the American Indian movement and the indigenous people's movement at that time, because it was building power and it was becoming a threat to the United States. And it was holding up the mirror of what happened to indigenous people throughout history. It was in that climate, in those conditions, in which the shootout happened.
And explain where Leonard Peltier was, why he wasn't tried at that time and could well have been acquitted with the other two.
He was in Canada at the time. He was in Canada at the time. He had evaded to Canada. And while he was in Canada, the United States government engaged in an illegal extradition from Canada, and they coerced witnesses, and they provided falsified documents to the Canadian government. And those falsified documents, the coerced witness, it was later found out that, of course, those were contributed to the illegal extradition of Leonard Peltier from Canada back to the United States, but they continued his prosecution anyway.
And talk about who Leonard Peltier was and is, Nick. His significance in the community, his standing back then in 1975, and what he's been able to do from prison right through to now, and then want to ask about the lockdown.
Well, Leonard Peltier was an organizer and an activist of the American Indian Movement that helped fight for the Native American Freedom of Religion Act, that helped fight for the Indian Self-Determination Act, that were fighting for many of the things that we are beneficiary of today as indigenous people. And they were fighting for liberation of people and the rebuilding of indigenous nations. Also, he was doing so, organizing as a boarding school survivor, raising awareness about what was happening in at that time in Indian country. And so he created the conditions, many of the things that we benefit from today throughout Indian country, but he has never been able to benefit from them himself. Now, from prison, he has been a writer. He has helped raise money and awareness around indigenous issues. He has continued to maintain his position as a human rights leader and bringing light to what's happening to Indian people, even from prison. And today, you know, he is one of the most world-renowned indigenous human rights advocates, and he's been doing that from prison. He has stayed his course, he has stayed strong, and he has helped bring light to indigenous issues, not just on Pine Ridge in the United States, but around the world. And so he is revered by Indian country as a leader, and it would mean the world to have him come back and have him released from prison. And I think it would absolutely be part of the legacy of the Biden administration and its relationship to indigenous peoples of this land.
Is there any indication, and I'll put this question to all three of you, whoever wants to take it, of what Biden, I mean, I was asking President Clinton a quarter of a century ago if he's weighing clemency. He said, yes, we're looking at this. Maura, do you have any indication from the Biden administration right now?
I have not been in touch with the Biden administration. I think Nick may have a better sense of that.
Nick Tilson.
Where it's at right now is there's a pending application. There's a pending application to move forward for executive clemency. And President Biden could act on that any day. He could act on it any day. If we're going to sit here and think about the political landscape, the biggest likelihood of him doing executive clemency will happen after the election, before the inauguration. So during that time is the absolute time that we have to build up the pressure and put the pressure on him. And so at that time, we'll have more of an indication of what's happening. You know, we're maneuvering. The FBI is one of the biggest challenges right now, is because the FBI continues all of these, five decades later, is continuing their effort to keep Leonard Peltier in prison. And so we have to rise up and, hope that the president of the United States has some courage, some compassion to do what is right and to release Leonard Peltier through executive clemency.
And Jennifer, if you could talk about the lockdown right now, Jennifer Jones, lead counsel for Leonard Peltier.
Yes, absolutely. These lockdowns have been chronic and consistent, particularly for the last 4 years of Leonard's incarceration. They are called modified operations by the Bureau of Prisons. But what it means for Leonard, someone who is an elder, who is medically vulnerable, it means that he does not get the diabetic food that he needs, the exercise that he needs, the religious services that he requires, and he is locked down for 22 hours a day, only allowed to take a shower. But it's uncharacteristic right now because I've not heard from him in over 7 days. And that is concerning. Obviously, it is heartbreaking because he is sitting in lockdown on his 80th birthday, or was sitting in lockdown on his 80th birthday. And really, this is a form of solitary confinement and a means of hastening death by incarceration. All of these different characteristics of Leonard's incarceration are, in fact, means of death by incarceration. So we wholly object to the lockdowns. We believe that Leonard, and we have requested a medical transfer. It is wholly inappropriate for him, for many reasons, notwithstanding his medical reasons, for him to be at USP Coleman 1, sitting in lockdown, reliant on a walker at 80 years old.
Well, Jennifer Jones, as well as Nick Tilson, Jennifer Jones and Maura Meltzer-Cohen are co-counsels. Jennifer is lead counsel on the Leonard Peltier case. I want to thank you all for being with us. But I wanted to ask Jennifer to stay with us for 1 minute so I can also ask you about the federal jury verdict in Florida that's found members of the Pan-Africanist group Uhuru 3 guilty of conspiring with the Russian government to sow discord and interfere in U.S. elections. Activists with the African People's Socialist Party facing up to 5 years in federal prison. They're going to appeal. Prosecutors arguing the group's activities were not protected by the First Amendment since they were done, they say, at the direction of a Russian operative. The defense arguing the government aimed to censor the group after members criticized U.S. foreign policy. Jurors acquitted three of the activists known as the Uhuru 3 on more serious charge of acting as agents of a foreign government. Jennifer Jones, the significance of this verdict.
Yes, absolutely. The trial of the Uhuru 3 is proving to be one of the most important First Amendment cases thus far in the 21st century. And though the verdict appears to be inconsistent in some ways, it demonstrates that the First Amendment is a viable defense to such accusations of being foreign agents when exercising First Amendment rights. And it should signal to the government that juries will not so easily leap to convict Americans or anybody else in these political or politicized prosecutions. But at the same time, because the Uhuru 3 was found guilty of the lesser charge, it also shows it isn't necessarily penalty-free and that conspiracy laws, which are often broad and confusing to juries, are still being used to traffic folks who are not guilty of the underlying offense, yet by conspiracy convictions are on the road to prison or punishment nonetheless. And so it is a bittersweet verdict, which everyone should be aware of. Because it remains clear that when covert government repression tactics fail against activists, the government will use the overt means of charges and cages against folks who simply they disagree with.
Jennifer Jones, a part of the Legal Support Committee for the Uhuru 3, and also lead counsel for Leonard Peltier. Coming up, How We Do Freedom, Rising Against Fascism. We'll speak with V, the playwright formerly known as Eve Ensler, about the day at the Judson Church planned for Saturday. Stay with us.
Here in the dark, everything that once was becomes a tiny spark. Looking back from the next century, and what do they see? The names of the girls who laid the stones, names long forgotten, never scribbled in the tomes, but they were strong and indestructible. Their hearts were full. Now the edifice of women's liberty, it is almost complete. Protected and serene, the rich women still are holding their malevolent skills, growing bolder in their treachery, selling for free. They are those who were willing to fill the fight. Their sisters cross the land and declare them quick to cry, saying don't trust them with the
by Aoife O'Donovan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. A day-long event scheduled at Judson Memorial Church here in New York City Saturday is called How We Do Freedom, Rising Against Fascism. Speakers, poets, artists, activists will be crowding into the church, billed as a discussion on the way fascism impacts everything from, quote, women's bodies to anti-blackness to suppression of LGBTQ+ and the disabled to the banning of books erasing history and immigration bans, union busting, increasing violence and expansion of the police state, and the destruction of the earth, end quote. The event is organized by V-Day, 1 Billion Rising, and Judson Memorial Church. We're joined right now in the studio by V, the playwright formerly known as Eve Ensler, founder of V-Day and 1 Billion Rising, global activist movements to end violence against all women, gender-expansive people, and the earth. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This is an event that spans the globe. People will be talking about fascism from India to the United States.
Exactly. I thank you so much for having me this morning. I when we had our gathering of our global council of 1 Billion Rising in Rome in June, which we do every year, we kind of determine what's going to be the issue of the year and what are the most pressing issues women are facing. And it was unanimous within a half an hour that the rise of fascism from India to Italy, from Afghanistan to U.S. was the most pressing pressing concern everywhere. And I think this day, which I'm very excited about, we have a range of the most brilliant philosophers, thinkers, activists, artists, all who are going to be responding, telling stories, presenting theories, artistic responses to those theories, and hopefully inviting everybody into a deep exploration of what is fascism here, everywhere, and how we build a movement that can resist it.
I want to play a clip that you have highlighted. Dalton Clodfelter, host of the Right Dissident program, he was speaking in 2022.
People say, well, I'm sort of like, you know, I'm like the 1920 feminist. You know, I believe women should have the right to vote, et cetera, et cetera. No, that was evil, too. That was terrible. Our country started really going down the pooper once women got the right to vote. That's evident. The facts of the matter are women are dumber than men. Women should be subservient to men. Women have no place in male activities. Women have no place of partaking in the workforce. Women have no place of partaking in politics. Women have no place outside of the home. The home is a virtuous place for women. Women should be happy when they are in the home. Women should be grateful when a man puts a roof over her head.
That's Dalton Clodfelter, host of The Right Dissident. How alone is he, or what movement is he a part of?
Well, it's hard to tell the numbers, but he's certainly represented by J.D. Vance, who is running for vice president. We're seeing a very strong push from the right wing to make sure that, let's just look at abortion rights and the fact, what we've seen over the last year. I read this statistic recently that 64,000 babies were born last year to rape women who could not get abortions. That's in America, right? We're seeing the pushback of women back into the, quote, family, back into the home, the idea that women should now have the vote removed. That, and I think we're seeing this actually across the world, this repression of women. I mean, one of the women at our gathering and who we'll hear from during the event on Saturday, the oppression of women in Afghanistan is the extreme, most extreme form of oppression. It's kind of the end of women, period. You can't go out, you can't speak, you can't laugh, you can't have jobs, you can't do anything, essentially, but have babies and be quiet, right? And I think there is a Talibanic movement in this country that would like to see women in the very same place. And I think part of what we know is that when women's rights are threatened in such a perilous way, it's representative of all of our rights being oppressed in a similar kind of way. So I think the day is really looking at, like, one panel, for example, is looking at the body, right? The oppression of transgendered women's bodies, the oppression of disabled women's bodies, the oppression of obviously pregnant women's bodies and our right to determine whether we have babies or we don't have babies. But it's also across the board, whether it's the scapegoating of migrants and immigrants, as we've seen with this mad, I don't even want to repeat it, it's so ludicrous, but the lies that are being told, the plans for expulsions of millions of people in vicious and violent ways. I think what we all have to do now is really come together to think deeply about what are these rising fascistic impulses that have been here all along in this country. They're certainly not new to Black or Indigenous people who have lived forever in that kind of precarity, but they are spreading and they are deepening. And with Project 25, the kind of outline of this policy Bible, which is literally spelling it out, you know, beat by beat, we need to be prepared with our own Project 25 as a counter proposal.
V, I wanted to ask about your piece in The Guardian titled "The Forces of Loneliness Can Cause Political Instability." Explain.
Well, I think one of the things Hannah Arendt always talked about is that loneliness is often a precondition for fascism. It feeds off of it. And because people are lonely and they want to attach themselves to things, then they want to kind of find a cult or a way of belonging. And I think, you know, in 2023, the Surgeon General came out and said that the greatest mental health crisis facing America was loneliness. And if we look at the combination of neoliberal capitalism and the pandemic, and now this ongoing everyday malevolence coming from mendacity coming from the right wing, I think it's pushed people into a powerful state of isolation, loneliness, where they're facing ongoing anxiety, dread, a feeling of not being wanted, a feeling of having to prove themselves and their right to be here. And it's created mad isolation and mad disconnection. And I think one of the anecdotes to fascism we know is community, is solidarity, is coming together, is talking, is being part of something that is bigger than yourself, where you are protected, where you, each of us stands for each other's rights. And I think, you know, one of the things I tried to say in this, in the piece about loneliness, is that it's up to us now to create a movement that is so powerful and so strong and so welcoming and so inclusive and so interdependent that loneliness vanishes and we become strong in our numbers.
So one of the things about this event is not only the critique of fascism, but developing the strategies on dealing with it. And what do you think are among the most important global strategies in this last 30 seconds?
Think one is to recognize that it's a global problem. And to see this as something that's happening through the rise of strongmen everywhere, right? The expulsion of immigrants and escaping, the hatred of women and the destruction of our rights and LGBTQ, the erasing of history, the religious nationalism. And I think one of the greatest strategies, I think, is educating ourselves, knowing what it is. I often bring up the world and people